down the drum.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 810.1CH1633, certificate number 27581, Mother Earth's Plantasia.
This was actually going to be an entry about women's suffrage, a listener request.
Can we go back and... and do that instead of whatever this is?
Well, I'm not against women's suffrage.
Sure.
I wanted to sing the song from Mary Poppins. Everyone wants to hear me sing the song from Mary Poppins. You know this.
Well, now that you've said it, I think that's how we have to end the episode.
We will do that show, but I realized as I was getting my notes together that this show is actually getting released on 420. We're going to this is going to go into the time capsule on 420.
I thought you were going to say, this is our 351st episode.
Well, that's actually what I was looking at. I was about to say, this is our 420th show. And then I looked and I was like, wait, that's 70 off.
I was like, is he doing this in homage to the Ford 351?
Yeah, finally. No, this is our 420 show.
Thank God.
And
I'm so glad that you're finally recognizing 420.
Well, it's one of our most important holidays and observances.
That's right. 4:20 p.m. at 4:20.
So maybe you want to hold off on listening to this till a certain time of day, if you know what I mean.
We used to celebrate it at 4:20 a.m. as well, but that's advanced stonership.
Like you would actually get up early. You're not still up.
No,
you're not still up. You all go to bed early like kids on Christmas Eve. You set your alarm. You sneak downstairs.
Set your alarm for 4:15 because you got to be ready.
Blearily wake and blearily bake. And of the two shows I wanted to do, Mother Earth's Plantasia sounds a lot more appropriate for 4:20.
It's a very omnibus-y sound. Mother Earth's Plantasia.
It's the name of the omnibus weed store we're going to open to fund the time capsule if the Patreon goes south.
It sounds like something that hippies would like fry and eat after their children were born.
Oh, I see. You want to get the Plantasia.
Yeah, a little bit of
it's full of iron and vitamin K.
Hippies.
Do you have a, what would you call your weed store? Have you thought about this if you were to open one?
Oh.
In newly progressive Seattle?
You know, it never occurred to me to come up with a name for my weed store. I'm still like very much locked in the game that we have around here, around the house. You know, we used to play There's You, right, which is one of the great games of all time.
It's a classic.
And There's You, you know, it's also sometimes can be like There's Your Boyfriend. But
offensive.
Yeah. But since COVID, of course.
Shouldn't you explain There's You? Maybe you talk about this on your other shows.
No, I mean, There's You is just when you're out in the world and you see something or buddy. It can be anything.
Broken down fire hydrant.
That's right. You just point at it and you say to whoever's next to you in the car, there's you. And it's endlessly hilarious. And especially if it's a person who's wearing like a ridiculous hat or somebody that's just clearly like, look at, you know, what you normally say, like, wow, get a load of this guy. Instead, you say, there's you. And then there's the surprise. All great comedy has an element of surprise. The person turns to survey the scene, recognizes the focus, and then realizes that they've been burned because
Well, there's you. There's always, them. They should know they've been burned. There's you is never a compliment, right? It's never like a supermodel posing in front of a right. shop window.
It's always, yeah, it's always a three-legged dog or something. And sometimes, especially once the game has evolved over the source of, or over the course of many years, it takes on this tremendous nuance where, you know, there's, you can just, you can point
it. Is it ever in corporeal forms? Like if somebody's talking about, you know, a vague sense of dread or something, do you ever say there's you?
There, it has gotten, impressionistic at times, right? You're like there's you and the, and it's just the sky filled with smoke. But then, you know, it roots itself again in the real, but since COVID, of course, we don't go anywhere. We're never in the car. Why would we go any place? I mean, the only reason you get in the car is to go to the dentist, I guess.
That's it. That's the one exception. The streets are full of people going to the dentist.
I haven't been in a car in months. And so there's you. It doesn't play anymore. So it's,
you could just pick things around the house.
There's you.
The blender broke. Yes, you did that last week.
But we know all those. We know everything broken in this house, including primarily me. But it's transmogrified into
yes, yes. What is the new game?
The new game is when someone says any combination of ridiculous three words, you know, if somebody says, oh, the toaster is on the fritz, you say, you're a toaster on the fritz. Like, that's a bad example because you shouldn't have to say the word the. If you say like, oh, there's a, you know, there's black mold in the walls, you say you're black mold in the walls.
Right.
And it has become one of the great games around the house because you kind of have to wait for the coinage, right? You can't just, it's gotten to the point where anytime someone says something in our house, like black mold in the walls, there's this pregnancy because everyone hears
who's gonna
it.
Say it.
Yeah. You hear it in the room and it feels almost like shaving a haircut, you know, like Roger Rabbit. You're all bursting at the seams. Who's going to say it? And now, of course, and I'm trying to train my daughter to understand that not saying it can create even more comedic, like pregnancy. That in and of itself is hilarious, because you know, surprise. It has to be surprise. You can't just say it about everything. Because she went through a phase where she would say it 40 times a day.
All each funnier than the last.
Yeah, and really trying to like land the joke over and over. And
my kids do that with your mom, but they don't actually. I don't know. Is it always an insult in your house, like the black wall of mold? Because my kids like it for the most arbitrary sentences. Like if you were to say, those tomatoes are in the pantry, but somebody accidentally put them in the crisper, and you're not supposed to refrigerate them. My kids will say, your mom's in the pantry, but she was in the crisper because you're not supposed to accidentally refrigerate. You know, like they'll do the whole sentence.
Yeah, we do that too. That I think my daughter was very interested in learning about burns because she had a bully at school a couple of years ago.
Who was zinging everybody?
He wasn't zinging her. He was just a true bully, right? Like a rude and insulting and like, you know, a quiet bully who would whisper insulting things. And I tried to
outwit him.
I tried to say like, here's how you get a bully like that. You use wit. And here's how you use wit. Like you burn him. And she was like, what is this burn? And I was like, well, burns are one of the great magic powers of bookish people. And so I've been trying to teach her burns, but it turns out that burning people is a subtle art, right? Because for the burn, because you can get burned by trying to like unleash a bad burn. The burn turns around.
And you know, a 7-year-old may not be equipped to see the subtle shades of
right.
What makes a great burn.
You don't want, yeah. So in trying to explain to her, like you don't want to do a burn that you don't want to attempt a burn you don't have full control over, because
uncontrolled burn.
Well, or just the burn turns.
It's like Apollo 13.
Yeah, you have to know every way that the burn could get turned around on you and be prepared for that also. So the game, like you're a black pudding, that is trying, I'm, you know, we're using it to try and teach her like the subtle art of of burns. And it's, you know, it's the education of my daughter. It's going to take 3 or 4 years probably.
You may have taught her a weird kind of burn that will not translate to the schoolyard. Can you imagine her?
You're a black pudding.
You're an extinct dinosaur.
You're a piece of broken chalk.
So you don't have a weed store name all ready to go.
No, and it's one of the, I mean, I definitely for years have said, well, that was my nickname in college.
Oh yeah.
Which is a good one anytime somebody says, yeah, like, wow, this is a thick piece of pipe.
That'll be on Omnibus out of context. Every time you say, that was my nickname in college.
But I don't, I wasn't walking around. I know that you're really good at that. The musicians, Paul and Storm, have a game, which is, you know, that was my blank cover band.
Yeah.
So you say a thing and they're like, oh, that was my Steely Dan cover band. But over the years, I've watched them do it enough that I know that they have patterns that they look for.
There's really only 5 ways to do it.
Yeah. I mean, if you can say Steely Dan and you can say John Fogelberg or whatever, but like they don't have.
All these things are just patterns.
It's pattern.
Like, right. What are the, there's a tiny number of just abstract, crazy geniuses whose brains are wired differently who can actually come up with some new joke approach or sensibility or format you've never heard. Everybody else is just like doing pattern recognition.
You know, you have a kind of wit that I don't have, which is the wordplay wit. Like, I don't do much wordplay.
Oh, yeah. The weed store should be a pun. John.
Exactly.
John.
Just shmurm or shmurm.
I mean, I have cannabis.
Oh, that's good.
So it's too easy.
Yeah, cannabis.
Should I open cannabis?
Well,
it could be a bus. It could be like an old bus, old school bus that I've repurposed.
This game is also name your Thai restaurant, right? Or name your Vietnamese, name your pho restaurant.
That's good.
Yeah.
Pho is better for naughty puns.
Yeah.
There's only 6 names of Thai restaurants.
But a lot of them, have Thai in them. Yeah, and they're. I guess the Vietnamese restaurants are very naughty. Right?
I don't like it when they're English puns, like if it's Taiwan on or what's the pho example? Pho King, right?
Yeah, right. Or Phantom of the Opera. So that's not. That's not actually
it says
one.
Pho and then it says Ntum of the opera. They have pho and they have Somtum.
No, you're right. When you see a Thai or a Vietnamese restaurant that has an English pun.
It's like, come on.
You definitely feel like you're going to see non-Vietnamese people in the kitchen.
You're pandering to me with that.
Yeah.
Instead of just trying to make the beautiful, authentic fruits and dishes of your homeland.
It's definitely the one you'll see in a mini mall rather than the one shaped like a boat.
Mother Earth Plantasia is not a pot shop of any kind.
Is it a pun? I don't get it if it is.
Well, it's kind of a pun. It's plant plus fantasia.
Oh, okay. Okay, plantasia, sure.
You thought it was placental. Well, but that's just because you read a few letters and kind of got a little bored with the word. Well, this has 3 syllables?
I mean,
tell me how it comes out.
You often have an omnibus topic where there is a word that that was coined, but coined in the 18th century and based in the Greek. This is a more recent... this is a more recent coinage?
Yes, and it's that's a good question. I wonder if anybody used the word plantasia before, because plants have been faddish. Plants come and go.
Sure, we did the fern episode.
Oh, sure.
Episode
example.
Not
that's
longer.
A great example, because during, you know, the same kind of interest in new and exotic parts of the world that produced fern, what do we call it? Fern fever?
Yeah, fern
in
fever.
19th century England kind of led to the whole, you know, just an obsession with all tropical plants. Suddenly the wealthy would have their hothouses and their orangeries full right. of...
palms.
Full and of, yeah, exactly. Palms and...
banana trees.
Exactly. Coffee and pineapple and, you know, all these things you couldn't grow in England with its... awful, smoky, dismal weather.
Have you ever lived in a house with a greenhouse element?
No.
Sunroom even?
No. Well, yeah, my parents have a big sunroom in their house now, and it's nice, you know. It has this quasi indoor outdoor. And the Victorians would do the same thing. They would fill their parlors with you know, big spreading fronds and leaves of all kinds.
Yeah, it feels like a Sherlock Holmes villain, right? That you enter his manor and it's all wicker furniture and
yeah. How come
palm
the good
trees?
The good people back then never had that? I guess there's some strong anti-colonialist vibe even in those stories written by terrible colonialists. Like, yeah. They knew it was more evil to have a house full of rattan than to not.
Yeah, rattan being the ultimate signifier of ill repute.
But plants came back in the late 1970s, the 70s, 80s, kind of in a big way. Like, the if you think about mid-century America, you know, Eisenhower era, the New Frontier.
Which I do every minute every day.
You're trying to create it in your new house.
I am, yeah.
But that wasn't, you will not be able to buy, you should not buy too many houseplants, because that was not a time of, you know, big dangly vines and things hanging from macrame things in the corner of every room.
It was white sugar and white bread.
Yeah, it almost might have seemed a little unhygienic to have things growing in your house,
right?
Because
you need bugs or dirt.
Right, you've got, yeah.
The opposite of clean.
And your white closeted husband comes home and spends all weekend clipping things back to make the outdoors look more like the indoors.
Right, he's got a topiary dinosaur on his front lawn.
You don't want the indoors to look more like the outdoors. But in the 70s, we started letting our body hair grow, and the corollary to that was just ficus everywhere.
Yeah, man.
I don't know what the fashionable plants were, but...
Well, you remember in the 80s, it was a derisive term for a certain kind of yuppie restaurant, the Fern Bar.
Right, right.
I've thought about that as an omnibus episode, but I could never really get my toes...
But that's kind of the establishment co-opting what was kind of an anti-establishment, you know.
Oh, right, of course.
I'm your fun, cool, hippie aunt, and I've got a million plants.
Did you ever know anybody that had one of those giant... hanging by macrame, giant terrariums that had, you could see the layers of dirt, and then it had some kind of plant.
No, but
world.
I'm jealous.
I had a friend whose mom had, and this would have been in the mid 70s, a bunch of those kind of hanging around the kitchen, big globes full of dirt.
Yeah, big dirt spheres hanging around the kitchen.
Yeah.
It was a big time for that.
Macrame, always macrame element.
Macrame, right? And it got normalized enough that today, you know, it's normal for everybody to have a couple of houseplants that they try to keep alive.
I have a dozen.
Do you?
I'm Mr. Houseplant.
Are you good?
What, I mean, my way of caring for a houseplant is when it starts to wilt, I water it. And then every once in a while, I stick one of those little fertilizer posts in the dirt. So I'm not great at it. But houseplants are resilient. I have a Christmas cactus that belonged to my dad that we've had in our family for 30 years. And we had a jade plant that did not survive. But the jade plant was a full tree. Like the pot that it was in was the size of a basket that you might find in Mesopotamia. I mean, it was a giant plant.
We kind of switched to... I think Mindy believes she will always kill every plant, but we've switched to, we have these two just unkillable plants that we don't really like very much, but we're...
Are they cactuses?
No, we actually killed the cactuses. It turns out you can't just leave them on a shelf and treat them like plastic hotel lobby cactuses.
Right, you have to care for them.
Once a year, you have to water them or something. But we do have some succulents that we water maybe every once a month,
that's
well within our skills. And these things up on the shelf, they just drape leaves everywhere, and there seems to be nothing we can do. They're surviving despite us, not because of us.
We bought one recently called a Z plant, which is a new fashionable plant that someone brought back from South America, and it seems kind of unkillable. They advertise it as unkillable.
It seems like it's going to start eating people in your plant shop.
It's a beautiful thing, right? I feel like giving someone an orchid is the ultimate curse. And I get them periodically. It's my birthday or something, and it's usually from a neighbor, not from a friend.
You're supposed to keep it alive?
Yeah, who's like, here, I got you an orchid, the most difficult plant to care for. And
it's a challenge.
It's like seasoning your cast iron pans. If you go online and say, how do I season my cast iron pan? You'll find 900 websites of these guys with leather aprons on, telling you, like, here's how you do it. It's very simple. And it's not at all simple, really. And keeping an orchid alive is the same thing. There's so many digests of how to keep your orchid flourishing. And
they all disagree.
If I look at an orchid from across the room, it wilts and dies. I don't know. You know, my daughter's mother / partner, not my daughter's partner, but mine, her father has orchids all over the kitchen. He keeps them alive, but he's a very meticulous man.
That's who, you know, that's a signifier in detective fiction as well. The old meticulous guy with a house full of orchids.
Orchids, right. Oh, that creeps me out right away.
Yeah, like Sam Spade or Marlowe shows up and is like, look at this weirdo.
Yeah.
I mean, there's probably some level of homophobia there. Like, oh, old Colonel whatever with his orchids, little light in the loafers.
Yeah.
I guess, I'm not sure. Maybe a 30s reader wouldn't have seen that.
You know, there's Mr. Miyagi, of course, who's taking care of
He's got bonsai.
His bonsais, which feels... That feels not weird, right? To have bonsais?
You mean it doesn't feel like orientalist or?
It's an
old Japanese American man could very well have a bunch of bonsais, so.
But if I had a couple of bonsais and I was always over there with tiny little surgical scissors clipping off.
No, it's okay. It's more like model railroads.
Exactly. Yeah. It's something that we imported, but immediately goes into the painting of Ronin. Category.
Yeah, exactly. And you could use it. You could have your D&D campaign go under the big tree. It could be like Lothlorien. We got Dylan a bonsai tree once because he was momentarily interested in them. And of course, it immediately died because he was only momentarily interested in them.
I was interested in turtles when I was in high school.
And this is my other kid.
It's a
new reptile every week.
I really, really wanted a turtle. And then I had a friend, or not, he wasn't a close friend, but I went over to his house and he had a box turtle. And in interacting with the turtle and the kid for just a very short amount of time, I realized, oh, this turtle is a huge burden. Not a burden of care, but a psychological burden to realize.
Just
like,
a bummer.
Well, this turtle is going to live to be 90. And my friend Joan has a turtle that she's had since she was a little girl. And she loves the turtle. It's like her familiar. Sits on her shoulder and it whispers in her ear. But this turtle, whose name is not Sydney, what is the turtle's name? I mean, the fact that I know Joan's Shelley. Turtle's name.
All turtles are named Shelley.
That's nice. See, that's the kind of wordplay that you're famous for.
Oh, I think it's really true. People do name their turtle Shelley, thinking they're the first one to think of it.
You know the story of the turtles that were painted, their shells were painted in the World's Fair, and then the paint inhibited their growth. And they,
yes.
Yeah. But this Sheldon.
Oh, there it is. It is a shell pun.
And you know what? I never made the connection until now. Joan's turtle Sheldon is.
And you said Sydney. Somehow Sydney Sheldon was in the depths of your brain.
I think of Sydney Sheldon a lot. But you know, she takes.
Well, it's because of our Sydney Sheldon book club.
Oh, right. Of course.
Our other podcast.
we were just talking about him every week for the last year.
The story of Mother Earth's Plantasia is actually the story of a guy named Mort Garden. This was requested by my son at dinner the other day, by the way. And I said, what podcast did you hear it on? He was like, nothing. I was just going down a Wikipedia rabbit hole.
So is
and
he,
I said, perfect.
Is he pledging to Omnibus at the $100 level? Because when did we start doing, shows that were suggested by our kids?
He did,
cause I would do a Dark Vader and the Empire every week. We allowed it.
Thrawn. Dylan's doing DoorDash now, so he has money. Should I make him give it the $100 level?
What do you mean he's doing DoorDash? Oh, because he has his driver's license, well, he's delivering
18.
Food?
I think you have to be 18. He's driving around with a little plastic tubs full of pad thai.
You're kidding. When did one of your kids ever get a job, first of all? But what?
No one's more surprised than me.
What does he use the money for? To buy Minecraft add-on?
I'm not actually sure what my daughter really wants the money. I think she has things she wants to buy, but nobody will hire her because she's 14,
right?
And the man won't hire her.
That's whereas, why you can't tax the rich.
Whereas Dylan is 18 and he just has no. I mean, I think one of his friends started doing it and suddenly had a ton of money.
Oh, right.
And you know, he knows we're not going to be lavishing stuff on him because we think he should get a damn job.
Exactly. It's that Protestant work ethic.
That's right.
Well, you were about to say that Kate had killed a lot of reptiles. Is that true?
No, she hadn't killed them. She's always requesting a different kind of reptile.
She's
you know?
So goth.
There's a month of... Oh, she is. There's a month of her wanting a turtle, then a month of her wanting a snake, and then a month of her wanting... And, you know, and we always say, all you had to do was feed your fish or ever walk the dogs. Well, you know, we'll see.
Burn.
We're on pretty solid ground, I think. in not adding a new phylum
a boa constrictor.
To the house. But I looked up Mort Garden, this guy Dylan mentioned, who I'd never heard of, and has one of the most interesting careers of any 20th century musician.
His name is Mort Garden?
Yeah, like all the great... that's true. That's a little on the nose, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of jazz musicians are named Mort.
Oh, I lied. It's Mort Garson. Oh, never mind.
Garçon.
he is not Garcon. He's not French, although he is Canadian, but he's like a child of Russian Jewish emigres who, you know, as you do, went from the shtetl to New Brunswick, sure. I guess. they were just crab fishermen,
right,
back in the Ukraine.
Famous Ukrainian crab market.
So he's born in the mid-20s in his parents' new home in New Brunswick, and he is immediately just an incredible musical prodigy.
Oh.
He can do everything. You know, he just sits down at a piano and never takes a lesson and could just play anything he hears on the radio, which is infuriating.
Yes.
Because I feel like I would like to have that kind of shortcut to talent.
Right, me too. My grandmother was like that. You could name any song.
And she would just sit down and play it?
You could sit and whistle the refrain of a song, just like, or, you know, whistle the melody, and she would sit at the piano and immediately begin to play the song. And no one knew how she did it, and it's just, she was a prodigy. No, it didn't translate to any of the rest of us.
You're a musician.
Yeah, but I can't sit and play. I can barely play my own songs.
My dad took a few months of lessons, quit because he was, you know, off on doing something else. And then, but he'd do the same thing. He'll just sit down and, I mean, it's for him, it's more like he actually took the time to figure out the chords and play with fake books. And, it's annoying to me, not because I've had to work hard for that same thing, but just because I feel like more, I shouldn't have to.
Right. There are a lot of things you can do that other people can't though.
Oh, I'm not complaining.
Yeah.
I'm very blessed.
Yeah.
Hashtag blessed. But Mort went to Juilliard, and after serving in World War II, he found that his services were in demand on both coasts because people could see this guy can do it all. He's a conductor, and he's a writer, and an arranger, and a singer, and he can play keyboards. And so he becomes one of the leading session musicians of the kind of mid-20th century.
These were the Steve Allen days, too, where... The demand for somebody to sit at the piano and just kind of chat. And
that was his thing. You know, he would, his credits are like a ton of Doris Day and Mel Torme records, you know, soft pop. You'll also see him on, he plays on Paul Revere and the Raiders records. And he did the string arrangements on By the Time I Get to Phoenix by Glenn Campbell. So that, you know, it overlapped with a certain kind of soft pop. But, you know, he it was straight out of this kind of 50s lounge thing where... you just needed somebody to kind of do easy listening chords at the piano. And in fact, he sold a lot of records by doing easy listening arrangements of, if you bought a bossa nova record during that fad, it was probably arranged by him. He had whole records of, kind of Muzak arrangements of Beatles and Simon and Garfunkel songs.
He was Guitar George and he knew all the chords.
He did, seemingly with no effort. He wrote, three hits, or co-wrote, he wrote the music for three hits with a lyricist, two I've never heard of and one I have. Dynamite by Brenda Lee, no idea. Theme for a Dream, Cliff Richard, no idea, sorry, British people. But he co-wrote, and this was probably what let him retire in 1963, Our Day Will Come by Ruby and the Romantics, which maybe you... Our day will come.
Yeah.
And we'll...
It's on your playlist every time I'm over at your house. Yeah. It comes through your Sonos.
As soon as you walk in the door, I play Our Day Will Come. I keep thinking, is it my theme? I keep thinking you'll get the message. It's like a doo-wop kind of a... The Ruby and the Romantics were kind of an Akron R&B group. Did I say Akron? Like,
you did.
To rhyme with Dacron?
You did. Akron.
Yeah, that's what the city is going to be called in the future.
Akron,
welcome
Ohio.
To Akron, citizen.
So you know Betty Lee and the whatchamacallits, but you don't know a single song by Cliff Richard?
Well, I mean, I don't know Theme for a Dream. I feel like Cliff Richard, if you're British, you know.
Right. It's like Robbie Williams.
He didn't. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Like they kept trying to make Cliff Richard happen over here and it never happened. But he has this remarkable career in just kind of lounge piano and arrangement. In 1967, he's also interested in the technical side of music as a session musician and spending a lot of time in the studio. In 1967, he's at an audio engineers convention and he happens to meet a guy named Bob Moog.
Bob Moog.
I'm sure has come up on the Omnibus before.
We've talked about him.
He has just invented the first commercial synthesizer. Which, you know, I was looking at pictures of Mort with his Moog, and I guess I never realized how unwieldy the Moog is. Like, it's
not not portable.
I was picturing the mini Moog of the 70s, where everything really was kind of packed into a keyboard with a panel, kind of like the synthesizers my dad was playing in the 80s, or Flock of Seagulls was playing. Got your pitch wheel. But the original Moog was just a wall full of components, like one of those European circuit kits you get.
Yeah.
And you had to decide, well, I'm going to plug in this filter to this generator to this amplifier, and then I'm going to plug in this joystick, and I'll do the pitch wheel with this joystick. Like, it wasn't like it did have a keyboard.
Yes.
But there was also a bewildering array of have you ever played on one of these old?
I have seen them, and you know the little mini jack patch bay element of the big Moog. I don't think it was mini jack. I think it was quarter inch. But it was a fashion in the 90s, 2000s to make a little Korg that actually had a small patch bay. But the thing about the Moog is that before the mini Moog was invented, when there were these giant apparati, when you heard them on albums, I mean, there were albums, it's like the theremin. There were albums that were made to showcase this instrument, which were not really like pop music, not anything you'd put on. And then when you heard
it's very, very hurtful to Hooked on Bach, which I play every time you walk into my house.
Tubular bells. but then music for airports, which have you ever listened to music for airports in an airport? It's very effective. I used to put it on when I would go to airports and put my headphones in and listen to music for airports. It's just like, wow. Okay.
I put it on for dinner quite a few times after we did that, entry.
Oh, you did?
On Eno. Yeah. I actually like it for, kind of keeping the kids chill.
Yeah. It's groovy, but it really chills you out in an airport. It, you know, closes out all that CNN yelling, but when the Moog would appear, the real Moog would appear on pop albums, it was never
fit.
It was never an essential sound. It was always an effect. Not you know, it was like panning when panning first came into being, and you could hear the pan as an effect, and you're like,
It took you out of the sound, song.
But later, you know, after the mini Moog, of course, Moogs on pop records are ubiquitous, or were.
Yeah, so Mort Garson was just fascinated by this new technology, and he liked the unearthly sound of it. You know, Moog came out of theremin. That's why he got into electronic music. And, Garson loved the unearthly quality, but not because of kind of its space age, you know, what we associate with early synth, which is kind of a futuristic forward-looking thing. He liked the creepy theremin kind of thing of it because he was a bit of an amateur occultist. Like, he started putting out these kind of spooky, unearthly, ethereal records under names like Lucifer and subtle, right?
Yeah,
subtle.
Lucifer's
first album, and didn't he have some other Ataraxia? You know, he had. Just for this kind of new age meditation. You know, he wasn't trying to. He didn't want your kids to be sacrificing goats or whatever.
Ataraxia was the third Santana record. So he was making, this was the era of the hi-fi too, right? So there are all these dads with tube amplifiers.
Big headphones.
Yeah, sitting at home with their reel-to-reels looking for something something spooky to play to really feature their high-end Macintosh equipment.
Sure, and this is where you get Wendy Carlos Hooked on Bach, and then eventually, Prague, and then it's all downhill from there.
Yeah.
But
Mannheim Steamroller.
Exactly. Christmas music. It all turned into Christmas music. The two best genres, Prague and Holiday. Mort was a very early adopter because he had just met Moog at this trade show. And so he releases the first album on the West Coast, recorded on the West Coast, that has a Moog synthesizer in it, around 67, 68, before the Beatles or anybody has started to experiment with electronic music. And so he becomes associated with these kind of unearthly bleeps and blorps. And it turns out to be an amazing career move because suddenly he's the guy that you go to for that kind of music, to the degree that when Apollo 11 landed on the moon, I think at least one of the US TV networks backed the footage with his kind of theme music. He was the John Tesh of eerie moon music because he was like, yeah, I'll make you a little boop, 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 boop. And he started to get work in movies doing the same thing. He did the soundtrack for, this guy had the most amazing career. He did the soundtrack for Beware the Blob, Larry mm-hmm. Hagman's directorial debut, I think, mm-hmm. and maybe lone credit. He did the music for a version of The Little Prince that Richard Burton read that won a Grammy. And of course, he kept, in addition to these, you know, one for him, one for me, these sellout projects, he was also doing his own little Lucifer stuff, like Beelzebub. He was trying to bring about the arrival of the Great Beast by for A&M Records. He did 12 different kind of new agey albums, each about a different sign of the zodiac.
Oh yeah,
here's the bleeps and blurbs for Aquarius, right?
the murder albums,
and I guess he sold a lot of copies of Music for Sensuous Lovers, which is a genre I'm not really aware of, but it was like they realized they could sample kind of moans and groans into Moog music.
And then filter them in such a way that it masks.
Yeah. So you get kind of a, you know, it's not Barry White, but it's a very overtly sexy kind of electric orgy going on in your hi-fi.
Right, an aural pheromone where you're...
Aural sex.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
And so he is now the king of this kind of a thing. You know, he's...
King of the thing.
He's gone from being lounge bossa nova guy to being, you know, the guy who knows where his pitch wheel is. And
the arpeggiator was a big invention in this.
You want to hear classical music, but you wanted to hear instead of chords.
Move that chord around.
Hey, John.
Hi, Ken.
Have you been keeping up with the new t-shirt designs?
I think that our current t-shirt designs are so awesome that I don't want them to expire at the end of the month. I want them to go another month.
They are continuing throughout the entire month in which you are listening to this.
Hooray!
That's for sure. If you haven't looked at the designs, you can go to omnibusproject.com/store, where our current t-shirt designs reside. This month, there is a... two omnibus classics. There's a Chick Tract inspired shirt with a fictional omnibus theme. It looks really good. It's kind of drawn in the plausible style of a Chick Tract.
Yes.
And it looks great. And I like this one too. There's the Peachy Folder, which instead of the normal, what are the normal athletes on a Peachy Folder? Let me see.
There's the tennis. There's the basketball. There's the football.
There's a batter.
There's the skier.
But this one has you playing rugby. This has me. What am I even doing? I'm interviewing. I'm metal detecting for. What do we call this? The floating feet. The Vancouver floating feet.
Oh, the classic 50s sport of metal detecting for feet.
Or maybe I'm interviewing them. I have like a mic. Like I look like a. I look like I'm doing a 50s man on the street interview with the floating feet.
Okay. It's cool looking in any case.
And then there's a bear holding a missile. I don't even know. How does that relate to Omnibus? And the famous mascot of our show, Bear Holding Missile. Mm-hmm. You love him. You know you love him. These are very cool designs, thanks to our friends at Mediocrity.
They are super cool, and I think they are they really exemplify what Omnibus is all about. And if you're wearing one out in the world and you see someone else coming through the rye wearing an Omnibus t-shirt, you'll know fast friends, perhaps... life partners.
And in fact, it's required to do one of those jumping chest butts.
Oh, yeah.
Even if the pandemic is still going on, I'm sorry.
Even if you can't jump.
Right. Even if you have a half-inch vertical, you still got to try.
Propel yourself at the other person by whatever means of locomotion you choose and collide with them.
If you enjoy Omnibus and you are not wearing Omnibus shirts, you can check that out at omnibusproject.com/store to see what cool things are available.
And going forward, there will be new t-shirt designs there all the time. We kept these over just because they're so great and demand has been so high.
In 1970, Joel and an ex-TV writer, an ex-Gilligan's Island writer named Joel Rapp, I guess burned out of TV, and he and his wife Lynn opened on Melrose a shop called Mother Earth's Plant Boutique. He was kind of an early adopter of this new age... you know, yoga and vegetarianism. You know, it's an age of all these get in touch with the earth kind of counterculture elements that we've talked about many, many times. I was about to say ad nauseum, but no, I loved the Whole Earth Catalog show. It was a classic.
What's weird is there are still shops on Melrose.
to this day. And like many of the shops on Melrose, he got a hip clientele. Like every celebrity came in because he would always have the weirdest new fern or bamboo or whatever it was.
Right.
And he was just in time for this dawn of, we love the earth so much, we're going to put weird jungle plants in our houses or in our Hollywood Hills courtyards or sunrooms or whatever.
Yeah, Anthony Perkins came in every couple of weeks and bought a new palm.
Got some weird carnivorous plant. And yeah, you know, it was exactly the right era for this. While I was doing this, I was like, when did like the Swamp Thing get created? You know, when did DC Comics decide there should be a supernatural plant fighting crime? And it turns out it's the year after Plant Boutique opened, 1971.
No kidding.
Both. And the funny thing is, Marvel Comics had its Man Thing. Brooding swamp creature made of, vines and tubers. And DC Comics 2 months later rolled out Swamp Thing, its own brooding bayou creature made of plants.
When was
and
Little Shop of Horrors written?
Oh, that's interesting. So the original movie, the Roger Corman movie, I think is early 60s. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the idea of turning it into kind of a schlock thing that's more about exotic plant culture is, that's true. So there, I guess that it is, it's a 1960 movie set in an exotic plant shop, but it's a weird, grimy New York subculture kind of a thing.
Right, know? Right, right. New York. So it's
down on Skid Row.
Yeah.
But this is, LA is now the center of our culture and houseplants are back, baby. And this also coincides with a rise in, you know, the idea that plants are important because we must love Mother Earth. And mm-hmm. what if there's a Gaia theory that all of nature is linked into one interlocking semi-sentient web of life.
Yeah, right. The plants can feel it when you yell at them.
Exactly. So that's what comes out of this idea, this pseudoscience around what if plants are people too?
This was the source of my science fair project in 1975.
You did one of these play heavy metal to your plants or
that's
whatever,
right? I absolutely did it. And
I can't remember, did Black Sabbath make the plant throw or
the
die?
The problem was I didn't have exposure to that many kinds of music, so I was playing classical, but then, I don't know, Elton John. It's not like Elton John is going to hurt a plant's feelings.
It might.
It's going to make a plant feel like... Yeah, have some cocaine.
Honky Cat kind of hurts my feelings.
Does it? Yeah. Oh, sure. I didn't realize that.
Very sensitive. So that generation of kids playing music to houseplants or, like, you know, whatever, putting chocolate in their plants or whatever, this all came out of this early 70s boom of pseudoscience around what if plants can feel, mm-hmm. what if they can think, what if they can sense, what if they can communicate, which really hit the pop consciousness with this documentary called The Secret, or a bestseller, a 1973 bestseller and subsequent documentary called The Secret Life of Plants.
Which I think we refer to, Perry. I mean, isn't The Secret Life of Plants just, I feel like it's in my common vernacular.
Do you think Secret Life of X predates Secret Life of Plants?
No. I mean, I always attend plants to Secret Life of.
So The Secret Life of Pets movie is a
Secret Life of Plants pun, yeah.
Wow. That's blowing my mind. I have not read Secret Life of Plants, but I looked at the documentary yesterday.
Oh.
And it starts out on pretty, you know, it starts out on, it's like most of these Eric Van Doniken things, it starts out on firm scientific ground. It's like, well, you've heard of George Washington Carver, haven't you? Well.
And then the Moog music starts.
And then it introduces us to an Indian scientist named Bose. His full name is Jagadish Chandra Bose, who actually was a real pioneer of radio and microwave technology, you know, kind of the Marconi of India, and really the first Indian physicist of his stature. You know, he was knighted and, you know, back in the day when people would unironically say, he's a credit to his race. What? You know, that was the kind of thing they would say about right. Chandra Bose. Because, you know, legitimately a great scientist in many fields, but close to the end of his life, he became very interested in talking to his plants, basically.
Okay.
And, you know, started to do slightly kookier experiments on plants. So after name-checking Bose and Carver, the documentary just veers into really really nutty territory of, you know, a guy hooking electrodes up to his plant and then thinking about burning up the plant and watching the electrodes go. Blah, 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 blah.
Just because plants are psionic.
Yeah. Within 5 minutes, the movie has gone from, you know, plants are sensitive to changes in their environment to, well, plants can clearly read Kevin's mind.
Whoa.
And then later they're like, there's something where they're killing brine shrimp and it really bums out the plant that these brine shrimp are dying. So the plants are very quickly getting. True? Oh yeah.
Can plants read your mind?
Plants are so bummed about brine shrimp.
Okay.
No, that's the thing. So these experiments were pretty much wackadoodle stuff.
This is the cold fusion of its day.
Yes, and you know, there's no attempt to actually sell the Academy on this.
It's a new age.
It's a new age movie.
So it doesn't have to be rooted in anything.
Well, I mean, they get Stevie Wonder to do the soundtrack. It's not a. I mean, it has some synth on it, but it's not. You know, it's more. It's going to be more like a. Hammond organ, and the movie is full of Stevie kind of wandering around. I don't see him a lot not wearing glasses, but in these music videos, he's just kind of wandering around waterfalls and swamps and deserts.
This is young Stevie.
Yeah, his hair kind of looks like a macrame thing that you would put a plant in. It's got the cool beads and braids.
So mid-period Stevie. It's not like teenage Stevie.
No, it's right around the time of all his greatest records. It's right on the heels of Talking Book and Songs in the Key of Life. And, yeah. But you don't see him without glasses much. So you're really kind of, I got a little worried about him in this movie because he's just kind of wandering around singing in the savannah somewhere. at one point he's like standing in a rowboat with a daishiki, like in the middle of a pond. And I'm like, is he going to be okay? Like, does he know how to get to shore?
Right.
But he did, apparently.
Maybe
I shouldn't have been concerned.
He just communicates with the brine shrimp and they tell him where the shore is.
The plants were like, Stevie. But the song, let's see if I can find the track titles are fantastic. You know, it's a double record.
Of course.
And of course.
Once you get started, how can you stop?
It's about half instrumental, but half of these songs have lyrics, and the songs have titles like Venus's Flytrap and the Bug, Come Back as a Flower, A Seed's a Star, / Tree Medley.
These are all incredibly sexy song titles.
Black Orchid. I mean, what could be?
Wow.
Dedicated to Pam Grier, maybe, who knows?
These are all porn movie titles.
So this has entered the public consciousness, this idea that not only are plants an important part of the ecosystem, but they are friends and fellow citizens on planet Earth that deserve our compassion.
Sex partners.
Don't think about killing brine shrimp while you're with them. And somehow Mort Garden hooks up with the owners of the, you know, he's an
Mark
LA guy.
Garson.
Sorry, did I say Garden again?
Yeah.
Mort Garson hooks up with Joel Rapp, the owner of Mother Earth's Plant Boutique. And nobody remembers to this, you know, Joel Rapp is still alive and Garson's daughter has been interviewed about this. And nobody really remembers how this happened, but they came up with the idea there should be a promotional album of Moog synthesizer music that you would play to your plants. Because, you know, the main impact of this whole plant conscious thing was people just started feeling like they had to talk to their plants for 20 minutes a day.
Right. You walk in and you're like, hi.
How was your day?
Yeah. Oh, boy. But, you know, the plants are using ESP to calm you down and chill you out.
You don't have to talk to them. They should be able to know how the office was today, and if Mary Sue was a bitch again, or yeah, somebody took your lunch from the fridge.
My plants, I keep my plants in the bathroom, and so my plants are watching me pee, and that's weird. But maybe the tinkle sound is soothing to them, like, oh, it's like rain.
Maybe there are some similar sounds on Mother Earth's Plantasia, which is the album that
he sampled himself peeing.
It's got kind of rain-like sounds. The album is actually really great, I think.
Oh,
because
you've done a lot more research for this show than you typically do for an omnibus
than ever before.
You watched a movie, you listened to some albums.
That's pretty low impact work.
Yeah, I suppose.
You know, that's,
so
if I wasn't doing that, I would be watching a different movie or listening to a different album.
Yeah,
right. The records, all his records from this period, I think are really great because, you know, it's got all the of a, you know, Wendy Carlos's Tron soundtrack. Mm-hmm. But because he comes from this kind of easy listening lounge background, it's all very melodic and beautiful and relaxing in a way that some of these kind of uptight Hooked on Classics records are not. Or, maybe, wait, am I saying Hooked? Switched On, right?
Switched On Bach.
Switched On Bach. That's what I'm thinking of.
Maybe Mark Miles can drop in a little snippet right here of some groovy tunes.
Thank you, Mark. So you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really. I'm soothed right out, man. I don't know if we're going to finish this episode.
I see your plants perking up, but you're kind of sagging. The album had kind of this fun, fun cartoony houseplant on the cover in a very happy 70s style that could be straight from a Electric Company animation or, you know,
right.
Free to Be You and Me Nouveau style. And the album was very rare because it was a promotional item for this little plant boutique on Melrose. And for some reason, the internet has convinced me it was a giveaway with Simmons mattresses at Sears. So really, the only way to get this record of chill plant music was to buy a Simmons mattress at Sears or to go to Jewel Wrap's plant store.
Futurelings cannot see that I am making the Spock raised eyebrow, the dubious raised eyebrow response to this.
This is the most surprising thing you've ever heard on Omnibus.
Very confusing.
That you could get a New Age plant synthesizer record.
It's most illogical.
Yeah, I don't know if I believe the Simmons mattress thing, but that's in the memory of, I think, Mort's daughter. The controversy over whether the pseudoscience around plants feeling is not over. Do you ever see this in the, it's irresistible for people who write pop science headlines. This idea that, you know, your cactus can feel pain or your fern is smiling at you when you open the door.
Megan and Harry, are killing brine shrimp. One more reason.
Prince Charles does talk to his plant. Did I say that already?
Does he?
Prince Charles famously talks to his plants every day because he's a weirdo with no friends.
He's trying to justify himself to them.
Yeah.
My sister is a new ageist. She's not new age adjacent. She is a true new ageist.
Right down the plate.
And so all of this type of thing, she has told me repeatedly over the years, every kind of new development in the plants have feelings genre of conversation starters.
And you just shrug it off because your chakras are clogged.
I mean, you know, the non-person I talk to in our kitchen is the coffee maker. That is the relationship I'm trying to develop. Like, coffee maker, why are you so hard to interact with? And the coffee maker says, you are bad at interacting with coffee makers. And I'm like, I have done everything right here. I have followed the instructions absolutely impeccably.
I mean, coffee makers are becoming more complicated systems.
Mm-hmm.
If that growth continues, sentient coffee makers are inevitable.
I think I was more influenced by 2001 and the relationship to Hal than I was my science project where I played Elton John for plants.
I just think it's a hard sell to imagine plants as sentient. It's counterintuitive. Like, this Secret Life of Plants, about half the movie is time-lapse photography of plants, because if you speed a plant up enough, it will appear to be doing stuff.
Sure, waves, you know, dances.
Yeah, tendrils point towards the sun, mushroom caps kind of open like a smile, buds happily turn into flowers that might look like a little face. But if you're not taking a picture once a day, you'll have no sense that the plant is really doing anything. And, you know, plants do react to stimuli.
Yeah.
Plants will turn toward the sun.
Ancient people worshipped a lot of, what we would describe as pagan, although that's probably cultural imperialism, but they did a lot of earth worship. But did they worship plants? I mean, they certainly put pine boughs around, but
there were goddesses of gods, fertility. Especially goddesses of fertility.
But they were humanoid. They weren't the plants themselves.
Yeah, but is that different than, you know, the sun god who represents the sun? I mean, these guys would just worship anything you put in front of them.
But the sun,
it's like
a horny
teenager where no matter you put in front of them, they're like, ooh. any stimulus.
Oh, black orchid.
You take a prehistoric person and you're like, check out the moon. He'll be like, oh, I'm gonna worship that. Oh, yeah? Well, here's a thorn bush. Oh, thorn bush god, save us.
Oh, I suppose the burning bush
Oh, yeah.
Is the ultimate version of the, I mean, it was the bush, right?
Even
the
monotheistic religion was inheriting plant worship. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But, you know, today the experiments that happen in labs that you'll see in science magazines are a little more controlled than I thought about brine shrimp dying. There's a famous 2015 experiment in Australia where they took, I think it's called Mimosa pudica. It's that sensitive plant where you run your finger down the leaves and it kind of folds up. Uh-huh. Have you seen this?
But it's not carnivorous. It's not doing that because it thinks you're a fly.
No, I don't know. Who knows why it's doing this? It can't tell us. But the
it's if you run your finger gently down a plant, it maybe it's getting turned on. Maybe that's why it's folding.
Don't
in.
Put that one in your bathroom while you pee. The researchers put it in one of, in this little mount that kind of raised and lowered, like one of those carnival rides where your car woo goes up in the air and then drops you a little.
Oh, uh-huh.
So they put a pudica mimosa in one of those.
I'm just picturing them torturing this plant. The plant's like, whoa.
Well, that's the thing.
I'm 5 feet high. Now I'm 1 foot high.
I mean, if plants are conscious, the worst offenders are these people who are essentially doing the equivalent of animal research.
It's the one thing a plant would never do in reality.
Go on an amusement park ride?
Well, just go up and then go down and then go up again.
So here's the substance of the experiment. As they do this, at first, every time it gets that little jar, its leaves close. And then gradually reopens. Then they give it the little jar again, and its leaves close. But they found if they repeated it dozens of times, the plant would stop closing its leaves.
Oh, it gets accustomed to
it. Their finding is the plant has learned that that actually was not dangerous, and it can keep its leaves open and wait for a real danger.
The plant has learned.
The plant is smart like Joshua in War Games.
The plant is like a raven or a raccoon.
Well, and that's the question.
Can it open doors?
And, you know, critics of the experiment say the plant did not do that. It just got worn out.
Right.
It you know, you got it to close its leaves so much that it didn't have the leave closing Ganas anymore.
Critics are such killjoys.
And the Australian fluffy researchers say, no, you know, we did more intense things to it after that and it would still close its leaves.
Oh.
And the killjoys say, no, that's because you were doing more intense things to it. You know, it's difficult because, you know, plants do not have anything like a nervous system.
Right.
So if you're going to postulate that they have any kind of consciousness, it's going to be happening in some parallel or order that we don't understand the structures
Spooky
of.
Spooky action at a distance.
Really? Yeah. You're going to have to postulate a new set of cause and effect. You might say, well, there's no brain, but look how complicated the root tips are. Those could be command centers for all kinds of plant operation and behavior.
What they should do is after they've bounced this plant up and down for an hour until the leaves stop opening, they should then immediately start going on the y-axis super fast in one direction, super fast in the
it's
other.
It's just like when you get off one ride, you go on another to see if you can hurl your lunch.
Try and make the plant barf.
And I should make clear that even though there's one of these new plants can feel experiments in the papers every year or so, there was one this morning. Like I got on the internet this morning and they had put hydrogel on a Venus flytrap, and they were able to make it open and close at will with mild electric currents.
Further proving that this omnibus is the one you have researched the most.
You did three things?
It seems like pseudoscience relocating to Australia just makes sense to me, right? Like,
yeah, it's all Perth now. Now, but real mainstream botanists have mostly pushed back. There was a big, big splash in 2019 with some guys, including a guy here at UW, who are botanists, reasonable botanists, just fed up by this kooky new age stuff. And they want you to know that there are levels of consciousness, you know, found in many organisms. Hmm. And we have experiments to test them to see if spiders and crabs and birds and raccoons have things like memory and learning and intentionality. These are things you can actually test. And finding out that plants appear to occasionally, you know, are capable of some kind of classical conditioning, or at least behavior that looks to the outside like classical conditioning, that ain't it.
When a plant folds its leaves to say, some pig, I'll believe it.
So even though that discussion goes on, and, you know, it's still more current than ever, perhaps this is what has led to the internet rediscovery of Mother Earth's Plantasia. Actually, that's not true. I know what led to the discovery of Mother Earth's Plantasia, and that is DJ Shadow sampling it in introducing, you know, one of his many unauthorized samples.
Right.
And this thing had been a rarity for many years, you know, because they only printed a few hundred, I don't know how many mattresses or bamboos people bought.
It's like how we all rediscovered Pink Moon.
Exactly.
From
the car commercial. Yeah. And you can pretend you were into New Drake in the 90s, but you weren't into Drake in the 90s. In this case, the fact that it had been sampled and then it turned out to be such an odd disc from this odd period of culture with this odd artwork by this odd guy really caught people's attention, and it started to get passed around on YouTube. A documentary was kickstarted to try to find out what's the deal with this weird curio of a record.
It's Call Me and Say One, Prison Colon and Sinancusel.
Exactly.
All
it's
right.
It's the botanical version of Prison Colon and Sinancusel. And finally, in 2019, a small internet record company did re-release Mother Earth's Plantasia. You no longer have to pirate it. If you would like to hear the music of the plants, which one reviewer has called putting the synthesizer back in photosynthesizer, or avant-garden music, you can now get it from this tiny record company, which released it on green vinyl, or in a very limited edition on 8-track. If you would like to hear Mother Earth's Plantasia in a form on which it was never available.
Now, those are my people, the ones that are still listening to Mother Earth's Plantasia on an 8-track.
Are you gonna get it on 8-track?
You know, I have a 8-track player in the headboard of my purple
of your waterbed
bed. Yeah.
Of your circular waterbed.
Yeah, built into it. So,
well, you could play it for your plants.
It's like the cover of Mother Earth's Plantasia is, it looks like it has a Shel Silverstein.
Yes, it's goofy, naive children's illustration. It's like you think a Sesame Street guy with a big nose is going to come out and say, pee, plants, pee.
And that concludes Mother Earth's Plantasia, entry 810.1CH1633, certificate number 27581 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the very likely event that you are a sentient plant and have been listening to this episode alternately fascinated and furious.
This is the first music for your people. This is like probably the equivalent of some kind of terrible minstrel show or something.
Well, this may be the thing that brought about consciousness in plants. They may have responded to this record and been like, yeah.
There just wasn't good enough music before. That means you could play music for coffee maker, Brian Eno's music for coffee makers, to your coffee maker, and it would come alive.
I'm gonna take my Roland Juno 106 and take it upstairs and be like.
I mean, if we have plant listeners, really, plant consciousness is thought of as, this amazing new age movement, but it really has disturbing ethical consequences. If we actually do prove that the plants are thinking and feeling all around us.
Every time you make a cup of tea, it's a crime against plant animals.
Like every salad is as bad as veal. I mean, it really would legitimize any kind of devouring of nature, because there's no safe, sentient, free vegetarian alternative.
I mean, human beings are the virus here.
Sure. That guy that zapped the Venus flytrap to try to communicate with it, like.
He's a Mengele.
He's making he's trying to turn them into robots. Like, that guy's going to be, that's the first slave ship of the plant, whatever, Terminator peon robot movement.
Well, on the, on behalf of Ken and myself, we apologize, future plants. For grossly misunderstanding your sentience. I mean, we talk often about the Aspens, which, as you know, all have record players now, and the
Elevate tracks,
the mycological universe of peoples. So,
if those Aspens are quivering, don't come delivering, they say.
Ding.
Quaking. They don't quiver, they quake.
They quake.
If the aspens are quaking, don't come...
Baking.
Baking? Mm. Maybe.
Faking. Don't come faking.
Good words to live by.
Anyway, you can communicate with us through a time portal by tweeting at Ken Jennings. You can find us on what I hope is the eternal funding source of Patreon at patreon.com/omnibusproject. It will be the future government, basically, will be Patreon. I'm also on Patreon at John Roderick. You can email us, and please do. Ken will read your emails, and then once a month will send me sort of a digest of every email that mentions my name.
It's a service I provide. And in fact, I'll do that for any listener. If you want me to just go through your email once a month and kind of tell you what's up.
Tell you, well.
TLDR.
Yeah, tell you if anyone mentions you. Periodically, he sends me these, you know, the ones that are like, oh, by the way, John. But the rest of them, he, you know, the ones that are addressed to Ken, I never get to read.
Well, if it's a personal message, you know, generally they're saying something to the show.
Right.
Do you want to see all of those?
Yeah, you don't give
me those
to read
either.
It's going
to be like, you guys said Eastman Kodak was founded in 1896. In fact, it didn't change its name until Eastman Kodak until 1897.
Yeah, don't send me those.
That's kind of what I thought.
You can interact with the Futurelings, with your fellow Ferns, at any one of the social media sites under the heading Futurelings. That includes Reddit and Discord and Discourse, presumably.
Especially Facebook.
And you can mail us wonderful packages of the soil you grew up in. Don't mail us soil, please, but especially
it's
not night
illegal.
Soil.
Yeah, don't send us your night soil.
Oh, right. It would be in violation of all these don't transport fruit across state lines.
I did some hike in Hawaii, and you had to like brush off your boots before and after in case you had a little burr or seed pod or spore stuck to you.
That happens to me all the time. I fly to Hawaii covered with spores. well, you know, you go through one of those chemical exposure showers where you have to stand in the airport and just get hosed.
That's because they know about what you were doing in the American Express Spore Lounge.
You can mail us things at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
We haven't recorded in a bit, so I've got a ton of mail here.
I see that.
Lorenzo from Queensland, the land of plant experimentation, has sent you Vegemite. Did you disparage Vegemite?
You know, my friends in Inglang are fond of feeding me whatever their version of Vegemite is.
Marmite.
A Marmite, which is just awful. You know, they'll hand me, like, as a joke on the tour bus, the guys in Keene used to put Marmite on a piece of toast, and I love toast. And
hey, we all love toast.
I always assume that toast with a spread on it is going to be good. I assume it's a kind of jam. And they would put Marmite on it, and it smells and tastes like feet.
If peanut butter and gel and or jam had never been invented, sure, take this yeast stuff from your lab and put it on bread. I'm sure it's very nourishing.
They don't use peanut butter because apparently that's one of the things like root beer that never made it across the pond. But I'm repulsed by it. But I also don't like Nutella.
Weird.
Yeah, because I like a hazelnuss, but put it in a chocolate bar where it belongs. Don't grind it up and put it on bread.
You have a single serving.
Oh, he didn't send me a giant jar. He sent me this.
Well, it's hilarious to me that they have these, like the way we would have butter or ketchup or Taco Bell sauce in a little pack. They have Vegemite. Those of Vegemite. And he lets you know that this is actually enough. This tiny amount could give you two or three pieces of toast. Maybe you're using too much.
Is he going to make me a Vegemite sandwich?
He says it's up to you. Put butter on the toast first, and then a slight smearing of this. So
a little tiny smear.
Maybe the problem is Americans just use too much.
That might be it. We use it as though it were jam.
I think you're going to be a little more excited by what Andrew sent. Andrew is a cartoonist who, like most of our listeners, draws plus-size furry romance comics. And he's a fan both of the podcast and Legos. We recently did a Lego show.
Is this like Omaha the Sex Cat? Does he draw furry plus size sex comics?
I'm going to assume yes. He's not. Andrew's not here to answer for it. So I'm going to say absolutely.
Sign up for that.
Yeah, so please subscribe, John, Andrew. He has sent you a Lego Porsche.
Oh, how cool. It's a 930.
911 turbo, actually.
Well, I know, but a 911 turbo is actually a 930, I think.
Sure.
That's what they, you know, this is all internal Porsche talk.
We'll save it for the 911 show, John. This is the 420 show.
Oh, that is a hot car.
It's pretty great.
That is great.
And this is going to be very exciting for your daughter. He sent the Millennium Falcon. in bag form.
This is crazy because we are currently building an X-Wing fighter upstairs.
I saw. It comes with Luke, Leia, R2-D2, and General Dodonna, in case you don't have a General Dodonna.
We actually had a long conversation about General Dodonna yesterday because I was like, who? But now we have the Millennial Falcon.
The kids today are not ready for a world in which old white men run the rebellion.
Yeah, what are we talking about?
Because we've got hip, multicultural Oscar Isaacs running our movement now.
Right, but General Dodonna was...
There was a time when they all looked like Charlton Heston.
In 1975, it was like, well, we got to get a white-haired guy.
They'll know what's up. But look at this.
How cool is that?
And even best of all, he actually made a little Ken and John... set of minifigures here.
Let me see. Oh.
See what you think about the likeness. Nice catch.
Let's see. That looks very much like you, except it's smirking in a Lego way, and that's a way you never smirk. And I look like how I'm going to look.
Yeah, your beard's a little white, but you know what? Your beard is kind of getting white.
It's just that my beard is a little long, and my daughter always wants me to grow my beard longer. So maybe this is my opportunity.
You know why? She wants you to look more like a minifigure. This is mint inbox Millennium Falcon, except you took it out of the box for shipping. Look, the decals and instructions never been opened.
Did this come from the land down under?
No.
Oh.
That would have cost... $10,000 to ship.
You know, you're...
This was Andrew, not Lorenzo.
Oh, I see. The one of you, you're wearing an Argyle sweater and a bow tie, which
I always wear.
If it doesn't actually express your fashion sense, it expresses your inner fashion sense.
I show up here and you're like, what's up, Tucker Carlson?
Yeah, how's it going there,
Poindexter? Todd Starnes, let's do a podcast. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.